You're listening to the Blue Box Podcast, and for the next 60 minutes, we're going to be talking about Doctor Who so that you don't have to. Hi, I'm JR.
Hi, I'm Lee.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Simon.
And tonight, we are going to be talking about a story that features a giant brain in a tank that feeds on the intelligence of geniuses from Earth history. A story set in a tower block where the old people turn cannibalistic and start feeding on the young people. A story in which a spaceship disguised as a bus full of aliens go on holiday to Earth and crash, and one of the local heartthrobs ends up running away with one of the aliens at the end of the story. And
spoilers.
Another story in which a science experiment goes wrong and a young girl called Dorothy blows herself halfway across the galaxy and gets a job as a waitress in a cafe on an ice planet. And do you know what the most amazing thing is? We are not reviewing an issue of 2000 AD. We are reviewing a season. We are reviewing a season of Doctor Who.
You know, JR, if I'd known you were going to kind of sum it up in such a concise manner, it would have saved me watching it.
Yeah.
And actually, it sounds quite good the way you put it.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like the best season ever, doesn't it?
Yeah. Tharg's Future Shocks it is.
Okay, but... well, okay. I think this episode is going to be about the dichotomy between intention and execution, isn't it?
Yeah, it's plainly.
Mm. Absolutely.
And my only complaint about season 24, and this is summed up in the title sequence, which I know you're going to moan about, so let's get it out of the way quick, Simon. The title sequence is of its time and really cheap. And if they had the money that the series has now to put the ideas that they had for the title sequence then on the screen in the way they wanted to, it would have been great. It's only the cheapness of it that lets it down.
It would have looked like the titles we've got at the moment, probably.
Exactly. It would have looked almost exactly like the titles we've got at the moment, because the titles we've got at the moment are almost exactly the titles from 1987.
And although it's not my favourite version of the theme tune, it's by far one of Kev McCulloch's least offensive efforts.
Yeah.
This is
agreed.
True. God, we're really trying hard, aren't we?
I quite like it, actually. It sounds very 80s.
Yeah, but it's okay.
It's kind of got a cartoony quality to it.
I think, and I think it's much better than previous effort with Colin Baker.
The Colin Baker one, yeah. I can't remember who did the Colin Baker one. It was...
that was lackluster. Name
escapes me. It just sounded like a poor remix of the Peter Davison ones. You wouldn't even think that it had been arranged by an entirely different person. It just sounds like a rearrangement.
Do you know I can accept all of that if it wasn't for that bloody awful logo? It doesn't even work.
But does the logo...
It doesn't work.
Does
it's
the logo...
not balanced. It's...
No, it's not balanced. But does it not remind you of something out of 2000 AD, that logo? That's obviously what they were going for.
Yeah, possibly. Possibly. I mean, it's definitely got a cartoony angle to it. And there is an angle to it.
It's kind of, the sort of italic bit at the top is cartoony, and the other bit is kind of futuristic-y, so it's kind of cartoony futuristic-y.
It's almost Comic Sans, isn't it, Simon?
Well, it's the logo equivalent of Colin Baker's coat, isn't it?
I can't believe you said those words, Mark. I'm trying to keep him in a good mood for tonight's podcast, and you've upset him already.
Wait until we get to dealt
with. I tell you what, I might start a campaign against brush script as well. That's pretty bad as well. It's almost brush script, that.
What's
top
the matter
bit
with him,
Doctor?
So, I can't believe... Miserable. I can't believe we're talking about fonts.
I'd rather.
Okay, we did ask the listeners to go on our Facebook page and vote these stories in order of how they enjoyed them. And we do have a result. And I did notice, while I was putting these together, that three of the stories had an almost equal number of first place votes. Ooh. And one of them didn't. So there is one definite runner-up, and the other three stories are all vying for top place, amazingly.
Wow.
But before we go into week 12 of Knox Box, I'll just leave you with a little teaser. One person voted Time in the Rani, his favourite story of the season. I will tell you who that was after we've done week 12 of Knox Box. Are you ready, guys?
Always.
Yep. Here we go then. 3, 2, 1.
Knox Box.
This week, Grant Knox has watched another four stories, starting with The Power of Three. I haven't rolled my eyes this much since, oh, that's right, Dinosaurs on a Spaceship. So much quirkiness and pissing about. The thought of Chris Chibnall becoming showrunner terrifies me. The scene with the Doctor and Amy on the wall is lovely, but the welcome back, Lefty, scene is the first time I found Matt Smith's performance annoying. So I think we can say he was a big fan of The Power of Three. On The Angels Take Manhattan, he says, "She's gone. Finally. Hooray." To be fair, the suicide scene and the one in the graveyard are both very good, but the story doesn't really grab me. The Statue of Liberty angel is a really good visual, but by this stage, the Doctor and River's relationship has become annoying. And then he watched The Snowmen, and he said this, "I really enjoyed this, probably my favourite of the season so far. Clara's great, as are the Paternoster gang. Or Menagerie a Trois, as I prefer to call them. The snowmen are genuinely creepy, and it's a lovely reintroduction of the great intelligence. The scene when Clara enters the TARDIS for the first time is brilliant." And finally, he watched The Bells of St. John. He said, "I really enjoyed this story up until that ridiculous scene on the plane. That's then followed by the rom-com-like shots of the Doctor and Clara on the bike with naff music to match, and then he rides the bloody thing up the side of a building. No, just no." Well, that was Grant Knock. That was Grant Knock.
Largely positive.
Moderately positive. Our man on the ground watching the Stephen Moffat era, so that we don't have to, of course.
Thanks, Grant.
So, shall we work our way back out of Knock's box? You ready, everybody?
Go on then.
Three. Yep. 2, 1. Zob-nob. Oh, God. Who did the backward vocal again? Was that Lee or was that Mark?
Who do you think?
Simon.
Who do you think? No, it wasn't Lee.
Yeah, of course it was Lee. Look, before I tell you who voted Time in the Rani as their favourite story of season 24, I was a little annoyed this week. Do you want to know why? Just let me take a swig of tea and I'll tell you. That's really nice tea. I was a little annoyed this week because I caught up with last week's Starburst Magazine podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And although I have teased it on this podcast a number of times and actually revealed the truth once, not that anybody remembers, Mike, the editor of Starburst Magazine, on the last Starburst Magazine podcast, gave away my real name.
Oh, my giddy aunt.
Not very nice. So I've decided...
Roberta.
Well, I've decided this week to tell you the story of how I became JR. You see, I was born...
I've been waiting 15 years for this.
Well...
This is behind the curtain.
This is behind the curtain. You see, when I was born in Yorkshire, my parents were... No, please. This is not that kind of a story. When I was born in Yorkshire, quite simply...
Can we dub the Hovis music over the top?
I was just saying.
No, that's what Lee was trying to whistle.
I know. He used to climb up morning every uphill every morning for a daily bread.
Oh, my God. It's the Lancashire accent where they roll their R's, you twat.
That's what they did in the advert. He went bread.
Did he?
He did.
Oh, I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah, I remember that it 'cause it was so irritating.
It wasn't very authentic. That music was bloody Largo for the New World. It's about North America.
That's true. Mm.
I was born in Yorkshire, and when I was born, my parents couldn't afford to get me a name. So, as I was growing up, they saved up their money. And by the time we got to the 1980s, they'd saved up enough to buy me two letters. But of course, there aren't any boys' names that are just two letters long. So they were still struggling and struggling Ed. To save up... Pardon?
Ed?
No, that's short for Edward, you twit. Honest to God. Or you could have Si. But that's short for Simon.
There's a Brazilian footballer who played for Everton called Joe.
That's a girl's name. Will you let me tell the damn story?
Get on with it.
By the time we got to the 1980s, they'd saved up enough money for two letters, but not anymore. And they were going to carry on saving until you got the Who Shot JR storyline in Dallas. And then everybody was talking about this fella called JR. And it suddenly twigged with my mother that JR's two letters long. So that was the name they got me. So as Mike, the editor of Starburst magazine, correctly guessed on the last edition of the Starburst podcast, my name actually is just JR, and even though I was already about 14 years old by this time, I was named after JR Ewing from Dallas.
Yeah. Wow. It's you and JJ Abrams, isn't it?
Gosh, that's the biggest tongue in a mouth I've ever seen, lodged firmly.
You've been watching too many jazz movies.
Oh, God. I know, that did come out wrong. Oh,
I thought it was going to be like The Simpsons and you were going to reveal that your first name was actually Jay.
I don't want to think about the idea that I've got my tongue pressed so firmly in the side of my mouth that it might come out wrongly. Thank you very much.
There I was thinking it was Jolly Roger.
I'll tell you what,
that was the best podcast we ever did. So season 24... Who cares?
Yeah.
I tell you what, Time in the Rani, favourite story from season 24 by Weird Bean.
Well, really? Weird by name.
Weird by name, taking the mickey by nature, do you think? Or do you think it really is his favourite?
That is quite possible. Maybe. I found it quite entertaining.
I think, well, we'll get to it. I'm going to tell you what, we'll get to it now, because obviously it's the story that came in last, so... before we do, though, let's have a few. We've got so many comments. Some of them are short, so shall we skip through a few short ones that just sum up season 24 before we get into the more specific ones? Drew Walco said, "Oh dear," when we said we were doing season 24. He said, "You boys have my sympathies." Stephen Schipansky said, "Best season ever." Sean M. Vale said, "Spoiled for choice on that one," while Tim Burrows said, "Pfft, really? In order of least terrible, and let's be clear, I think these may well be amongst my bottom four of all time." And then he gave the order of the stories. Richard Hugh Parkin said, "It's Hobson's choice, given they're all pretty crap." And Paul Mason said, "To be honest, all crap, but the right quantity of booze and just about watchable." finally for now, Bill Jennings said, "A horrible season, ranking them as I remember seeing them back in the 1980s, which presumably means he can't remember, he's not watched them since, but you never know, maybe he has, and maybe he's just banished it from his memory. His number one choice was Dragonfire, in which Glitz appears and Mel leaves. Number two choice was Time in the Rani. Hooray, the show isn't cancelled, and a new Doctor. In third place, he had Paradise Towers. Hey, they are doing poorly what comic writers like Alan Moore and John Wagner are doing so well." And in bottom place, he had Delta and the Bannermen. After two horrendous season 24 stories, and noting the trend, the moment when the Bannermen collectively stuck their tongues out at the camera, I seriously wondered why I was watching. In that instant, Doctor Who became fallible in a way that it never had been before. Okay, we'll have some more emails in a minute, but Time in the Rani, and I think, as we were just about to say, it's actually not unenjoyable.
You've got to be in the right frame of mind, I think.
I think you do. Hey, giant brain in a tank, feeding off the intelligence of geniuses from throughout Earth's history.
Yeah, that's what must have happened to me.
That's get brainwashed in a tank.
Sorry, I thought you were talking then. I thought it was just a dropout moment on the Skype. Oh, Time in Narani.
Everybody was just waiting for the tumbleweed to go by, Lee.
Oh, were they? Okay, yeah. Insert. At your pleasure.
You think you've got comic
I don't
time.
Like the sound of that.
Insert at your pleasure.
See, I can do it. Okay, what are we doing with Time in Narani? Are we talking about it? Or are we going to just
we're not skipping the next past one? It.
Oh, okay. Oh, what can be said about this? This is a weird one, isn't it? I think it's probably well known that it's got the feeling of a Colin Baker story. Pip and Jane Baker, I think, had problems, you know, doing a good doctor because they didn't know who it was going to be and there was no script editor. And I think from the latest Doctor Who magazine, which I quickly skimmed through, Cartmel wasn't very happy with Pip and Jane's writing, and but his hands were tied. And you can see that it changes throughout the season and Cartmel gets his hands a bit more into what the kind of Doctor Who he wants to make. But this is definitely a hangover, isn't it?
Do you know what, though? Series. And I don't...
They're a bit...
Before you move on to
it,
before you move on to another point, let's deal with that point. Yes, it kind of is a hangover, but at the same time, I think the central idea about the giant brain in a tank is very sort of Andrew Cartmel-ish. So I don't think it's as far away from the rest of the season as most people like to think. And some of the rest of the stuff there, Mel impersonating, Rani impersonating Mel, it might not be exactly the kind of thing they're doing throughout the rest of the season, but you don't usually get that kind of thing in Doctor Who. And
that
to me,
is blooming hilarious as well.
But yeah, and sort of to me, intellectually, it's not a million miles away from, say, in Paradise Towers, where the Doctor uses the caretaker's rule book to deceive them. It's a case of a deception using something of your enemy's in order to deceive your enemy with something of their own creation, almost, as it were. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I thought you were going to say something along the lines of it's intellectually similar to Shakespeare, because that's the kind of thing they would do, isn't it? Using
twins
that are girls that are supposed to be boys and things like that, and having Kate O'Mara dressed up as Mel. I mean, the fact that she's actually an extra head height taller and stockier, more stockier built and better built in certain areas, it's plainly ridiculous. But
it is for the reviewer.
Yeah, but
not for the Doctor, because he wouldn't know, would he?
No, it works in a writer's sense. Exactly, it works in a writer's way. If you were to write that in a book, you'd believe it. But, yeah, I don't know. I found that quite cringy.
It's got the demeanour of a comic, but like a sort of a pre-12-year-old comic. And I think I get the impression that's what they're aiming for. But what we've said about with the logo and everything like that, if that was the cover of a comic, you would expect a comic strip of that standard, of
Definitely.
That sort of level of story writing. It doesn't take any kind of analysis whatsoever from the off. How the hell did the Rani, I mean, you know, how the hell did the Rani manage to get into the TARDIS, shoot down the TARDIS, and, you know, and from that point on,
yeah, but that,
there's absolutely no point in questioning any of it.
Yeah, but that, just, that opening scene is just a means to an end.
Yeah.
They need to regenerate the Doctor. And
yeah,
besides,
yeah.
She is a Time Lord. She doesn't know how to get in and out of TARDISes. And she may have some kind of a master key if you want to sort of hand wave it away. It's not as if the Doctor didn't steal the TARDIS in the first place. So, you know, there's no particular reason why she shouldn't have a key to his TARDIS.
Maybe that's a bad example. Then I go from that then to things like Sylvester McCoy tumbling around. And that kind of feels like he's doing his... showing off, you know, oh, well, he's got clown background, so he's going to do a bit of that. And
because he doesn't know yet what he's going
to
do with the Doctor. And he's doing the clowning, and Pip and Jane Baker, in the absence of knowing who's going to play the Doctor, have written in all this dialogue where they sort of mix up the aphorisms and stuff. Mm. It's the kind of stuff that could easily have been pulled back out by the director, but he didn't. So perhaps it's the director's fault, all that kind of stuff is still there.
I would probably say it is the director's fault on that case.
Mm. Yeah, I think so. But
the
other
filters aren't working.
Yeah, because I think the director also is in the same boat as everybody else. He doesn't know what they're going to do with it either, because they're filming this while they're still writing the others. Do you know what I mean? If they'd have done what they did with, say, Castrovalva and filmed it later in the season, so you could have had the actor playing the Doctor get a story under his belt before doing the regeneration story.
Wow, imagine, yeah, but imagine that though, JR, because this is so wildly different to the end of the season where he's starting to become that kind of slightly power, you know, not power crazed, but you know, so that power beneath him and this chess playing thing coming out in him. That was later on. If you'd have put Time of the Rani at the end, say, you know, eliminating the story of the regeneration, he would have been a different person completely, and that would have really jarred.
I think it would have worked in that story. Put a doctor, put a darker doctor. You know, we always use that word darker, it's such a cliche. Put a more assertive, more controlled doctor up against the Rani, who's got another one of her amoral plans that involves killing innocent people just because, you know, that's a means to an end, rather than because she has any evil intentions. And her whole plan about the brain in the tank and the geniuses from throughout Earth's history, give her a doctor like the Doctor from season 25 or season 26 to spar off there, and you could actually had the story that Mark of the Rani should have been if you'd have left the Master out. It could have been a really interesting duologue between those two characters.
I agree, actually. I think that's a good idea. But what I meant was that if they'd recorded it first and then put it later in the season, the other way around sort of thing, it wouldn't have worked at all.
It's an interesting thing
that Sylvester McCoy is from a clown background becoming an actor, when plainly his influences are things like Charlie Chaplin and all that kind of stuff. But actually we had another clown, we had Pat Troughton, but he was a theatre actor playing a clown, and that there lies your difference. You get a really weighty actor in who performs brilliant comic timing and pitches it perfectly, and then you get a clown, a very good clown he is actually, Sylvester McCoy, but trying to act without any direction and any ideas in that first episode. And I just feel really sorry for him. I see his pratfalls and his tumbles, and the director hasn't picked up on it in the, you know, the cameras aren't doing anything with him, that he could be actually quite funny if he was directed well in that first episode, but it isn't. It's really quite, it's quite hard to watch for me.
Yeah. There are some bits that are hard to watch, no question. But at the same time, do you know, when I first saw this, when I was, how old, I don't know, 18 or something, and after having cringed my way through the two Colin Baker seasons, actually, you know, I'd, you know, hold my hands up, no kidding, there were bits in this story that I thought were absolutely dreadful. But at the same time, I thought the creature design was interesting, and I thought the tetraps, I mean, and I thought the concept behind them with the, you know, 360 degree vision and the fact that they were bat-like and the stuff in the caves, I found that quite interesting.
It's a classic example, isn't it, of great ideas but not quite being able to pull them off.
Because of how cheap the production is by this point. They're probably making Doctor Who at this point for something like half the money realistically, in, you know, in realistic terms, that they were during the Hinchcliffe and Holmes years. If you can forgive it, the cheapness of its production and the fact that some of the acting is blatantly not up to scratch, but then some of the other acting in there, you've got Donald Pickering and Wanda Ventham in there, for crying out loud.
Oh, you got a feel for Wanda Ventham. She's probably thinking, oh, Doctor Who, yeah, they made me look all glam last time I was on it.
And now she looks like a lizard.
Yeah.
And not a very exciting looking lizard either. Do you know what I mean? It's not got people like Roger Murray Leach working on it. But at the same time, I thought the quarry stuff was good. The equal of, say, for example, the quarry stuff in The Three Doctors. And the special effect of the entrance to the Rani's lair. I thought that was excellent.
As pointless as they are, the booby traps, as pointless as they are actually quite good. They're quite good.
Oh, fun, brilliant, yeah.
Especially when Bonnie Langford gets inside one.
Calm down.
And you know, in the bit where it's sitting in the water, I quite like that. They seem to realise that quite well.
Best special effects that Doctor Who had had up to that point, apart from the sequence CGI, with the bees.
The bees?
Yeah, the I don't know what they call them. The bit in the entertainment dome. yeah. That was shockingly bad. But you know what? On the money they had and with the resources they had at the time, what were they going to do? Probably this is the kind of thing that a second pass at the script might have said, you know what? We can't do that, so let's not do that. But, and you know, the funny thing is, that's two stories in this season where they've got bees playing quite an important role. But
why do you think what?
On paper, that was a really interesting idea. Go on, Mark.
I was going to say, why do you think it is that a lot of fans are prepared to forgive low production values in a lot of the earlier stuff?
I know.
But don't seem quite so prepared to do it for this?
I really don't know. But if you want me
it
to...
It looks different.
I was going to say, if you want... Well, not really, because if you look at the vid-fired 1960s stories, they just look like somebody with a video camera on a theatre stage. That's pretty shocking, to be honest. I mean, they look glorious in vid-fired because they've brought them back to the way they used to look, and it's quite amazing to watch them, but when you're watching them, it can be pretty hard to suspend disbelief sometimes. But going back to Mark's point, my theory on that would simply be it was shockingly bad, it got better, and... You know, it can't go back to being shockingly bad again, but it does. And so you don't give it a pass if you know it can and has been better.
I think possibly also, because this is Sylvester's first story, people are still trying to figure out whether they like him or not. And, you know, if it was, say, Tom Baker in his heyday, you're prepared to forgive it because you love Tom Baker and you're quite happy to watch him in pretty much whatever they all stick him in. Whereas... with this, he's really having to prove himself, and he's not being helped out by, you know, the scripts and some of the production values.
Simon, you were about to say?
Yeah, no, I was going to say it's on the older stories. You've got this lo-fi recording of low quality effects. So you kind of get this genre feeling. You kind of accept it because it's all part of the same effect. Mm. But by the time of the McCoy era, you've got real high quality. Recording visual,
well, except
with low quality effects.
The time in the run is a decent effect. No, it's all because it's all on OBV that it looks so poor. There's no filming. It's all.
Do you think it's
video.
Down to our age as well that the stuff from the '60s is that far enough away that we sort of look at it in a slightly different, in a slightly more reverential way, whereas stuff that's nearer to remember it, maybe not.
Let me put it another way. Say if you saw a badly photoshopped photograph in high resolution, then you see the mistakes far more readily.
Mm.
And if you take it down to a low resolution picture...
If that's the point you're making, then yes, that's true.
Yeah.
And going back to what Mark was just saying now, another thing is, with the 60s stories, we came to them through the novels.
Yeah.
So we had already venerated them before we even saw them. We already formed opinions on them before we even got to see them. And when we did get to see them, and what we actually saw were like stage productions of these high budget movies that we had in our heads.
Yeah,
it was a bit of a shock to the system at first. But then simply the fact that you could go back and watch them kind of gives them an extra dimension as well. Especially when so many are missing, you kind of forgive the ones that do exist so much more because you just feel lucky to have them.
I think with every era of Doctor Who, you can look for the really rubbishy made Doctor Whos, and they crop up very quickly. Even the Crotons look terrible. There's things in William Hartnell's era. The Chumbleys episode was awful, and then, you know, Time and the Time Monster. That sort of, you know, there's a whole load where you can just pick and go, God, that was absolutely abysmal. It was really, really terrible effects. You forgive it because I think a lot of the acting was a lot more kind of theatrical. It was more kind of convincing, and you didn't have. I don't say convincing. All right, that. I suppose, like Simon says, it's all part of a whole thing. Whereas this McCoy era seems very fractured with its sounds and its visuals and its acting and its directing. Everything just doesn't seem to gel very nicely. And it's also like the difference between analog and early synth, where you get this analog sound which is very weighty and muscly and heavy and lovely and beautiful, organic. And warm and organic. And then you go for the synths of the early 80s, where they were, oh wow, we can sample stuff, we can put it in here, but the technology is very thin and it gives a weedy sound.
But you
and
know
that's
what?
That's the same as the McCoy era for me. It just feels weedy. Just feels it, like feels like the Chuckle Brothers with a bit of science fiction thrown in.
But it that's all bollocks, because if you actually sit down, if you actually sit down and watch any story that was made before 1987, they suffer from all the same problems. The jump from film to video, some of the filming on video, some of the acting in some of those stories is atrocious. There's some really appalling scripts and diabolical dialogue. Special effects are a nightmare. And you say it feels off a piece, but I mean, you put on the Silurians and listen to that score, or even worse yet, the Sea Devils, and then you look at some of
the Centaurites.
Or even the very first Silurians in that first Silurian story. Mm. Love that story. But the Tyrannosaurus Rex is a joke. And the Silurians themselves aren't a great deal better, if you're going to be completely honest. I don't think the Sylvester McCoy era, and specifically season 24, is any worse in many ways than a lot of those other stories. But another thing about it is that after fandom had grown up and developed, and Doctor Who Bulletin had sort of arrived in the sort of 1980s, and by the time you get to the end of Colin Baker's era, when Doctor Who fandom has established itself as the fandom that hates the thing that it's a fan of, 1987, post-Trial of a Time Lord, post-Eric Sayward and his infamous Starburst interview, and post the sacking of Colin Baker, 1987 is the year when Doctor Who had to give itself a new life, had to be reborn. And I think they did a brilliant job of it. I think they did the right thing. And I think season 24, my personal opinion, I don't find it particularly easy to watch a lot of it because of the production, but in every other respect, I think season 24 is a series, you know, running on full. It's doing a brilliant job of reinventing itself, but it's reinventing itself younger than the Doctor Who from the previous year. So fandom is always not going to take to that. And I think a large part of the reason why we see season 24 as a failure is because fandom wanted Doctor Who to be older. And they got that.
I think you put your finger on it when you're talking about, you know, the rise of organised fandom. And I think you got more of a focus for people who are feeling negative about it. Whereas before, they were isolated. Now they're, like, in a group.
And that magnifies the feelings. And, of course, that received wisdom then echoes throughout fandom, and it's something that gets handed down from generation to generation. But actually, you know, Time in the Rani, I think it's got some brilliant ideas, but it's not great, because nobody on that story really knew what they were doing. You look at the next three stories that we're going to talk about, and I think every single one of those stories, with the exception of Sylvester McCoy not giving a brilliant performance because he's still finding his feet, and with the exception of the fact that it is cheap, there's no two ways about it, I think all those three stories do a brilliant job. And I think they're three of the most distinctive, three of the most entertaining, three of the most innovative, and three of the most imaginative stories of the entire decade. So shall we, unless anybody wants to argue with me there, which I'm not going to allow, I'm going to read another couple of... Well, does anybody want to argue with me there?
No, it's a really interesting point you make, and I understand completely what you're saying. And you're probably right as well. I say probably. But,
probably.
You know, I'm sure somebody will work it out that you're not. But it is. They are distinctive. They are very different from each other. And I think with more time, more production value, more acting skills and chops from Sylvester, it would have been a very strong opening season for him. But we'll get to each individual one in a minute, I'm sure.
Yeah, there are. You
so
know,
I'm partly agreeing with you.
In spite of what I said, there are definitely, definitely weak things in all three of those stories. But I think, all three of them, I think the strong points outweigh the weak. Let's take a couple more of messages because we've got pages of messages to get through. Weird Bean, who voted Time and the Rani, top of the pile there, says, all in all, not a great season, but Kate O'Mara's Mel impression, brilliant. As for Delta, well, Ken Dodd is surprisingly well-placed, and Gavrok is truly unpleasant, as villains go. Paradise Towers, love Richard Briers, but, well, need I say more? The 2000 AD and Clockwork Orange-esque bits really worked, as far as I was concerned. Dragonfire only comes last because of that cliffhanger. Throughout this season, I can really see what they were trying to do. They just were not quite there. Or maybe I'm just being a bilge bag. We've got Tristan Alfaro, who says, he just said something about Time in the Rani, he says the only redeeming feature of Time in the Rani is the casting of Sylvester McCoy, who became a wonderful doctor after a difficult start, and the effects of the bubble trap things. Everything else in it is awful. Oh, fair enough. Let's do one more and then we'll carry on. Paul Monk says, hooray, I love this season. It got me interested in Doctor Who again, when I had largely given up on it. His choice of stories, number one, Paradise Towers, wonderful story, full of great language play, and the best doctory moments we've seen since the Tom Baker era. The bit where the Doctor defeats the caretakers by quoting their own rule book is great. His second choice was Delta and the Bannermen, a nice little straightforward period piece. In third place, Dragonfire, and in fourth place, Time in the Rani. Nowhere near as bad as its reputation. There's loads to enjoy if you really look. So, that's another three of our emails. We'll get to some more later. Okay.
I know we're going to move on, but very briefly.
Oh, go on then, yeah.
I was going to say, Time in the Rani, is that the one that was voted the worst story ever? Was that the worst?
No, that was
in
the
Doctor Who magazine.
Twin Dilemma. Although,
it's pretty much down there, isn't it?
Shortly after this podcast comes out, Doctor Who magazine's next poll, taking us right up to the end of the Matt Smith era, is coming out, so we'll know whether Twin Dilemma is still bottom or whether Time in the Rani's replaced it. Yeah, Time in the Rani is generally amongst everybody's bottom three or five.
But I think in its defence, a lot of people, I think it becomes polarised like that because of its position in the series, because it was the first story of a new Doctor, because it was all new, like you say. So, you know, it would have to really perform in order for people to take it seriously, I think. So,
just before we get to the next story, I will say that none of these four stories are a DVD I wouldn't pick from the shelf and put on for fun. I could watch any of these four stories, just chuck them on an afternoon and sit and enjoy them. Genuinely, even in spite of, you know, some of the problems.
Even when you were hungover?
Oh, especially when you're hungover, I think. That Kevin hair of the dog.
Would do your head.
Oh, yeah. That is one of the problems. But look, there's three more stories in season 24. Which of those three stories would you guys suspect may have come in third place with 7 first place votes amongst the people who voted?
I'm going to guess at Delta and the Bannermen.
I'm going to hope it's Delta.
It is Delta and the Bannermen. Well, not a. Yeah, but you know what? Okay, Delta and the Bannermen. I think of the three stories that we're about to talk about now, I think Delta and the Bannermen is the one with the most problematic production. It's directed by Chris Clough, isn't it? And I don't think he's a bad director. I just don't think he's necessarily a very good Doctor Who director. It's perhaps the editing as much as anything else and the performances. I don't think he makes terribly bad choices as a director. I just don't think his cast have got the experience, a lot of them, to keep up. And I think the pacing and therefore the editing kind of suffers a bit because of that. And obviously I'm not talking about people like Don Henderson, but I'm talking about the young cast and the new cast. So you've got.
I think there's some great stuff in there.
Yes, that's what I was. That's
the stuff in the spaceport, I think, looks absolutely stunning. I think that's really good.
And actually, the casting of Ken Dodd, which everybody was appalled at the time, and so was I. Actually, I couldn't bear Ken Dodd. That was, you know, my granny's comedian, and I thought, what's he doing in there? But actually, I thought he did a really good job. And I read later that, you know, he would have been happy to take a villain part, and he would have taken it seriously. And I could see him doing quite a good job, and that was a good bit of casting, actually. And you're right, that whole spaceport thing was a lovely entrance and a good idea and something fun and something a bit different for Doctor Who. Very much the kind of stuff we'd get away with now, actually.
And you know what? I'm just going to throw a little idea in Simon's direction before he gets onto the subject of Delta and Abanaman. But the two American guys who are out in the field looking for the satellite, isn't it?
Yeah.
That they're looking for. Just trying to remember their names.
Wisemuller and Hawk.
Yeah, that's it. Wisemuller and Hawk. Simon, not a million miles away in terms of the tone of what they were doing with those two characters from the two robots and dinosaurs on a spaceship.
The camp ones, you mean?
Yeah. I'm not saying these two guys were like robots and that they were camp, but I'm saying that they're there to perform a function in the plot, but at the same time to be an amusing diversion for the viewer, which distracts, which kind of deceives you into realizing that they're going to be have an important function in the plot. Same as the two robots and dinosaurs on the spaceship. In other words, what I'm saying is, I find it very hard to see. People will always do this. If they don't like something, instead of saying, okay, I just don't like it, I don't like the tone of it, they will look for specific things and point at those specific things and say, no, don't like that. But actually, those two characters aren't that dissimilar from, you know, characters that have turned up in stories like Warrior's Gate, you know. And like I say, Dinosaurs on the Spaceship, there are often a pair of characters who will end up having a fairly important plot function, but that the audience is deceived into thinking are just minor characters who are in the background for a bit of fun or entertainment.
This is that style of writing is very similar to the Virgin novels as well, where you have disparate, is that the right word? You have different, different kind of plot lines or storylines rather, and they converge at the end. But you have to go on a separate journey with these people that have nothing to do with the Doctor, and then eventually they become very important. I think Lucifer Rising and all those early Virgin novels were very similar to that.
And that's just an interesting good way of writing. It's just
good writing.
Well, isn't that a trick that Shakespeare used, isn't it?
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah, well, pretty much most people. But, I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, the Virgin novels did it a lot. I mean, not just once or twice, but a lot. Left-handed Hummingbird is another one, you know, did a lot.
There you go.
Stuff.
I've mentioned Shakespeare in the same conversation as Delta and the Bannerman. There you go. I have made steps forward.
And I said Shakespeare about Time and the Rani. Hey.
Yeah. You've both made progress. I think this season 24 podcast has been therapeutic for the pair of you.
It's a cathartic experience. Yes,
we'll have to see if Mark and I can make any progress before the end of it.
Lilo and Stitch.
We'll see.
What? Lilo and Stitch. You know that film?
Yes, I love it.
Isn't it the same plot line as this one almost?
No.
Isn't it? When they're bringing a war, or they're bringing an argument from outer space onto Earth. I mean, that happens in a few things, doesn't it? But it just feels like it's, you know, outer space brings a war to, like Transformers, it brings a war to Earth, and Earth gets involved. It's the same kind of thing. Lilo and Stitch, Lilo is an experiment, ends up on Earth, and the hunters are coming to get him, and humans getting away. And the same here, isn't it? It's, the princess is escaping, landing on Earth, and being hunted down. It seems to be a very science fiction, very like you said, yeah, a very 2000 AD kind of plot. Actually.
And you know, not just 2000 AD, also. Also a very Russell T. Davis kind of a plot. You've got a romance in there. Yeah. You've got an interspecies romance in there. You've got it's period piece, and the music becomes foregrounded as part of the whole experience, like you had songs turning up in things like Voyage of the Damned and Daleks in Manhattan. And even the ideas, like the satellite that the two American guys are tracking, having a crash in space with the space bus with all the aliens on it. It's very 2000 AD, and it's very Russell T. Davis as well. Stuff chasing around on the motorbike, like you had in The Idiot's Lantern, and even in The Bells of St. John under Stephen Moffat. It feels very modern. I think maybe that's one of the problems this season, is that it moved Doctor Who on so far. It was a little before its time.
Oh, no, you're right. I mean, Andrew Cartmell, the input he's got into this season is incredible in so far as it really did push it forward somewhere else. But the problem is nobody else could catch up. JNT, I don't really believe, understood Cartmell's plan until maybe the last season. It felt like everybody was trying to catch up with him, including the cast and the direction and everything. So his ideas and the plans that he had and the writers that were doing the work with him wrote some, you know, these next three stories we're going to talk about. I really like the stories, actually. I like Delta and Bannerman's story. I like it. But it's just the execution that just can't keep up with his, his interesting ideas.
I think, looking at the plus points, I think this is probably one of Bonnie Langford's better stories.
Oh, I think it's her best.
I think she really reins it in.
Yeah.
She's still got to do the odd scream.
I think she absolutely shines in this, Mark. I agree.
Yeah. And I think if she'd not decided to quit, she might have, you know, gone on to be slightly more fondly remembered.
I think she would have suited the tone of the storytelling more than... Well, far more than she suited the tone of the storytelling under somebody like Eric Saywood.
Without trying to get too personal, do you think it's perhaps another reason, going back to what we were talking about before, where...
Preconceptions.
And people not being prepared to give them a break.
Yeah.
Bonnie Langford had not been a fan favourite, and then you pair her up with a new Doctor that people are trying to work out whether they like or not.
And of course, when she came in, that was in a Chris Clough directed two-story block as well.
Yeah.
And like I say, Chris Clough, brilliant bloke at certain things, perhaps not so much at Doctor Who, and seems to struggle again there. She doesn't get the right direction. She could have been a lot better, a whole hell of a lot better. And I think Delta and Bannerman.
She's a lot better.
Well, I think, yeah. But you know what I mean?
Yeah, she could have been.
She could have been a lot better in these stories, and I think in Delta and the Bannermen, she relaxes into the story, is far closer to her sort of métier. There's some really nice stuff in the first couple of episodes, before the story really kicks into gear, where you've got people actually just relaxing and being people, that you don't often manage to get in Doctor Who. And it's great. The bit where the
and
bus
crashes.
And you've
got Don Henderson tune on a piece of Rory as well.
Oh, yeah, Don Henderson's great. But, you know, where the bus crashes and the passengers get off and the bus driver and the conversations he has with the Doctor and stuff like that.
No, I totally agree, yeah.
I just think it's delightful.
Simon's got his head in his hands.
You know, he's been very quiet. I'll be honest with you. I would be untrue to myself if I started... It's a very thin line between looking for the positive and making excuses for it. And I just detest it. And I won't say that about any other story in Doctor Who. I detest it.
Did you rewatch it again this week?
I looked at bits of it and it just got so really uncomfortable to watch. Look, my
analogy
for this...
You know what you should have done? Go on, and then I'll tell you what you should have done.
Well, you know, I'm going to read the novel of it because... I've been listening to what you've been saying about the story, and actually, when you take those elements out of it, you think, yeah, it does work. Mm. It does work. But it feels such... It feels so localised, the fact that I know it's all to do with the locality of how they filmed, and I was going to make the point that maybe Bonnie Langford's performance is better because she's literally been taken out of a studio, and she's out of that kind of, the six walls.
Do you also think it's probably...
She's out of a theatre situation.
Do you think it's a case of that by that point she'd probably made her mind up that she was going to go anyway, so the pressure was off a bit and she just... relaxed a bit and just went with it? I don't know.
Possibly. Yeah, yeah. Maybe she just got... And Yeah, maybe it's got something to do with what Simon said about being on location, because there wasn't a lot of that in the rest of the only other story she did where there was any significant location was Time in the Rani, wasn't it? And she was all in the studio scenes because the Rani kidnaps her, and it's actually the Rani, as Mel, who does most of the location stuff, you know, apart from the episode one cliffhanger. But maybe it's just that she's relaxing into being in Doctor Who, because it must have been a bit of a shock to the system. It's not the kind of thing she'd ever really done before.
But I was going to make this later on, because I was going to kind of aim it at the whole season in some respects. But I think Delson Bannerman is so symbolises what I feel. And it does go back to how old I was when I first watched it as well. And I wanted to use the analogy of dad dancing. Right, you love your dad to the bottom of your heart, but when he gets up there on the dance floor, when he gets to a certain age, and you get to a certain age, he gets up there on the dance floor and starts dancing, and you just want to curl up and die.
Yeah, but that's because of how old you were.
Yeah, I know, but also the fact that you do respect this person, and I respected Doctor Who and I loved it, and it just suddenly felt like, what are you doing? Just
if
stop
you
it.
Had
you
been...
think you look good, and you
if you had
I'm
been
a great dancer, me.
If you had been six and at I don't know a wedding reception, and your dad had danced with you, then you'd have been chuffed. If you'd have been six when Delta and Abanamem wears on, with a busload of aliens crash landing in Wales, and this guy absolutely chewing the scenery, Don Henderson, chasing around after this lizard woman who's had this baby who's growing up at this ridiculously enormous rate, you would have loved this story.
Exactly. Yeah, Chuckle
possibly.
Brothers. Like
quite possibly. But I don't know, it just seems the judgment is so off. The filters are switched off. Yeah,
like I say,
you picked up on everything that I thought of it, but you know,
I think comes back to the director again. Like I said, shall we?
Move
on.
Well,
I want to hate the music with a passion. Can I just get that in? I really.
But
hate
you get
the music.
To see your hero, Kev McCulloch, on screen.
You do, yeah, in the rock and roll band.
Is he?
Yeah.
Is he really? Yeah. Again, trying to do the rock and roll music. What? It doesn't even sound. It's just awful. It's awful. And they had the wrong people in the wrong jobs. And I would this is as bad as I will ever get in all of the podcasts
we
ever
Simon.
Do.
Wow, Simon.
It
okay,
really is. I can pull back from here and I feel better now.
He's physically got his fingers embedded in the desk here. I'm going to have to pop
them out. Anyone listening, Simon
is
the nicest, loveliest guy, but...
I'm sure Kev McCulloch
is
a lovely guy
bile.
As well, but oh my God.
Okay, we better move on to the next story, which is Time Flight.
Oh my God.
Sookie Kark says, in terms of just the stories, then it has to be Dragonfire, then Delta, then Paradise Towers, and then finally Time in the Rani. But in terms of nostalgia and how much I enjoyed the episodes when they were first shown, in 1987 he was 16 and nothing could deter him from thinking that any Doctor Who story was rubbish, no matter how much his friends and family would pick on him for liking the show, it would have to be 1. Time in the Rani. This was played so often on my video player just for the effects that I wore it out. 2. Dragonfire for the melting face and for glitz. 3. Paradise Towers for the cannibal grannies. And 4. Delta and the Bannermen. And that's only last because he didn't like the love story. Alan P. Jack. He says, 1. Delta and the Bannermen. Loved the character of Ray. Had some nice touches. Adore Ace, but it would have been nice to see Ray in the TARDIS.
In words with Alan.
She's a bit...
In second place, Dragonfire. The introduction of Ace. Bye-bye. Bon-bon. Glitzy. 3. Time in the Rani. There are some nice touches in this story, but not enough. It promises lots and delivers little. I do have a fondness for it, though. Benedict Cumberbatch's mother in the form of Wanda Ventham. I loved it at the time, but now with time, see the cracks. Suffers from being written as a generic doctor. And in bottom, he's put Paradise Towers. Oh dear, has wattles as snood, and you can hear it gobbling. No cranberry. No cranberry can rectify it. Again, promises greatness, But then, oh dear, Tabby and Tilly nearly have a bonbon for dinner. Again, some nice touches, but just doesn't quite work. and then a quick one from Mark Clapham. Dragonfire is in his number one, which is great. Then a big drop, and Paradise Tower second. Another big drop before Time and the Rani, which is dumb but entertaining. And finally, Delta and the Bannermen, because I hate all that Happy Days 1950s retro bollocks.
Hey, we're 24. That's exactly the same rundown I did.
but there's only four stories.
And that man knows what he's on about. He's an author. He knows what he's on about.
Of the two stories we have left, one got 8 first place votes and the other one got 10 first place votes. Would you guys like to guess which of those two came in second with 8?
I'd say Dragonfire.
I'm going to guess Dragonfire.
Lee? Really?
I'm going to go Paradise Towers.
And Lee, you would be correct.
Really?
Ooh. Yeah. Do you know what? When I first watched season 24, like I say, Time in the Rani, very problematic with some of the acting and some of the production. But at the same time, you know, the Tetraps felt like the first proper Doctor Who monster, first proper new Doctor Who monster we'd had since, I don't know, perhaps the 1970s even. And the special effects were great, and some of the ideas, and being back in a quarry, it felt a bit like trad Doctor Who. And the thing about the giant brain in the tank and feeding on the intelligence of all these geniuses felt like proper Doctor Who. And then Paradise Towers came on, and as a sort of 18-year-old, whatever I was, Paradise Towers was problematic, and Delta and the Bannermen, I hated that the first time. It's only that I've been revisiting it that I've come to love it. And then Dragonfire comes in, and that feels properly like old school Doctor Who. And I think a lot of people felt that way. I think that's why Dragonfire's won, because it feels like proper old school Doctor Who. But we'll come back to that. We're talking Paradise Towers right now. And actually, I think Paradise Towers and Delta and the Bannermen are the two head and shoulders top stories of this season. Couldn't really decide myself between the pair of them. Paradise Towers, guys. I just think it's wonderful.
It's great, even with Richard Brise doing Custer the Cat voice all the way through.
I know. I was going to say that, yeah.
Especially, I watched a bit of it just to catch up on it, because I'd watched it fairly recently anyway. And there's bits where he does the voiceover of Tannoy, didn't he? And it is literally Custer the Cat.
It is Custer the Cat. I revisited this actually over the last week or so, I've got to say, in bits and pieces. And when I first watched, I think the first 10-15 minutes, I mentioned it to Simon, I think, saying, "Do you know what? I'm really enjoying this." And he gave me this weird kind of sideways quizzical look, as if to say, "What the hell are you talking about?" And I thought, "No, I'm enjoying this." But actually, as it's gone on, and I don't know whether it's because I've had a stressful week at work and I'm getting more angry by the day, but I've got more angry with it as I got through it. And by the time Richard Brise is walking around possessed, I just wanted to put my foot through the screen. I was thinking, this is absolutely abysmal. But that's only what I'm looking at on the screen. When you look at what's being written, it's actually a really interesting concept. I don't think it pulled together at all well on the telly, or actually even the writing itself isn't fantastic dialogue, but the concepts in it are great. But I'll come back to the cannibals a bit later, but the whole concept and the idea is fantastic.
Oh, it's got some wonderful ideas. And it's not Doctor Who-ish, but it is Doctor Who-ish in a funny kind of way. But some of those ideas, the kind of things you'd never have thought you'd ever see in Doctor Who. And yet when you do see them in Doctor Who, you just think, why haven't this kind of thing always been in Doctor Who?
Yeah, that's true.
Actually, we'll come back to Richard Brise in a minute. But Simon, I'm quite curious to see then, what you thought of Paradise Towers?
Pretty much the same as Lee. Interestingly, I got asked a while back to do, is it Doctor Who Online, that website where they do like a prologue and an epilogue to stories.
I
got given Paradise Towers. So I had to analyse this on the story level to try and work out how it was all going to work out. And, you know, and from that I can appreciate the story. It's actually got depth to it in as much as there's history. As irritatingly Grange Hill as the Kangs are, the concept Blue that their language is actually developed and has actually, you know, evolved through time, through the use of slang and what have you, and just, you know, modern speech.
Clockwork Orange.
Is quite a... Yeah. Lee's just said Clockwork Orange. And to have that kind of history in a Doctor Who story is lovely. So the author's obviously thought about it and thought how those processes would happen. It's very 2000 AD in as much as it's very Mega City 1. It's very, you know, the blocks where everyone's living. And I mean, it does... It's very science fiction in that respect.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
There was, as J.G. Ballard did a novel, didn't he, which was about, it was called High Rise, I think, actually, if I remember right, years ago.
I think you're right, yeah.
I think I'm right. And somebody told me, because I haven't got to that bit in Doctor Who magazine yet, because I think that's covered as well, but somebody told me that that wasn't the influence, which I thought it was. Apparently the influence was actually the writer going into Stephen White, isn't it?
Yeah.
He did this one. Is actually walking into a real block of flats and getting in a lift and having no numbers on the lift, so he didn't know where he was going. And it was quite a frightening concept of, you know. So that's where it stemmed from. It wasn't from an already kind of used science fiction idea about the towers being, you know, possessed or being in control of the humans and that sort of thing. It came from that, which I think is a great start. I love the idea that somebody can walk into a bit of technology or be involved with technology that is actually genuinely quite scary just because it's neglected.
Mm-hmm. Mark,
yes.
Yeah. There are one or two negative points on this one.
Shut up. I mean, you can go away now. Thank you very much.
Anyway, I mentioned Richard Pryor before, and yeah, when he gets possessed, it is a bit cringy. But I can kind of overlook that. Yeah. Is it the cleaners they're called, the robot things?
They're rubbish.
Oh. It's like the War Machine's stupid younger brother, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like a cross between the War Machines and the
what's
macro.
The drill for? That's what I want to know. What's the drilling bit for?
Oh, God knows. They're not doing much cleaning with that. Do you know what? That was the one thing that spoiled the Happiness Patrol the following year when they're getting chased around on these go-karts.
In the world's slowest go-kart.
Yeah. It's like, if you can't... Yeah, it's like, with the benefit of hindsight, if you couldn't get it on screen, don't try.
Those negatives aside, I love the idea of the cannibal grannies. I think that is just brilliant.
And the performances. And the way it's played out as well. The performances are wonderful.
Yeah.
And the performances of the caretakers are wonderful as well. And so
we got Clive Merrison in there. He's a brilliant actor.
And I think Howard Cook as Pex, he's obviously miscast because that's obviously not what Pex was intended to be, but it's still a great performance. And I think the Kangs, by and large, give really great performances as well.
Wife was very upset that we both voted this highly because she absolutely detests this story.
On account of the Kangs.
I think it's Richard Briers that pushes her over the edge.
There's one quite attractive Kang, though, I have to say. One of them is quite attractive. So
one of the red Kangs.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
There's one in particular who doesn't act quite as badly as the others.
Yeah. No, but the problem is with that is they're doing, like you say, the Grange Hill. It's probably pitched them to do it. Oh, no, we're doing this to kids, guys, so make sure it's... You know, like that's acting to children is what they're doing, and it's like the Chuckle Brothers. It's that kind of level of acting, and that's what lets this massively interesting story down. And do you know what? They've got the level of they're aiming at like 5-6 year olds, like you say with Delta and the Bannermen, their JR, that people, you know, the kids are going to enjoy it. And you've got this weird kind of Eric Saward little injection of the cannibals, which is a great idea, but it just counterbalances the whole thing, but not in a good way. It's too dark to me. That was too dark, and I still look at it and think, oh, that's too dark, because this is such a happy-go-lucky kind of way of directing something. Even though the story's a bit dark, the acting is all Kangs this, Kangs that, and having a bit of a laugh, but it's really dark that you're about to eat Mel's face off.
I think it's quite offset. It's offset Hansel, by the rest of it.
It's Hansel and Gretel. It's Little Red Riding Hood. That's what it
is. That works now you've said it. Damn.
It's annoying when he does that. Joe, you use the sort of analogy of the six-year-old child enjoying Delta and the Bannermen. Can you imagine, as a six-year-old kid, you get the Radio Times and you're sort of flicking forward to read the synopsis so you can, you know, try and get an idea of what's going to happen, and you see there's going to be a character called Binliner.
Yeah, but I think that's great because that's really evocative.
I like that, actually.
Yeah, like for a six-year-old, if you say there's a character called Gavrok, that means nothing. Mm. If you tell a six-year-old there's a character called Binliner, he's going to think to himself, what on earth does that mean? Why is this person called Binliner? Is this person going to be dressed as a Binliner? All these thoughts are going to be going through this kid's head. And when he finally sees what it is, and I think there's a really interesting thing going on in Paradise Towers where each of the factions has got a slightly different tone, directorial tone in the performance, so that the cannibal ladies are playing it one way, the caretakers are playing it another way, and the Kangs are playing it another way. And I think actually, because they're all playing it with slightly different tones, I think it works. And I think for the kids, that the Kangs, especially for the little kids, to see the girl gangs in the colours with the funny language, but that you can still understand and follow the story of, I think it works brilliantly. I don't think, I'm not sure Andrew Cartmell really intended this, but I don't think he gets enough credit for making Doctor Who a series again that the whole family could watch and get something out of. Because you've got to remember that a huge, huge part of the Doctor Who audience is not the kids, but also the kids' parents and grandparents. And if you think of somebody who has no interest in science fiction, probably doesn't go to the cinema, you know, a parent of young children, probably doesn't do much apart from going to work and being a parent, probably sits down to watch telly purely to turn their brain off and hopefully find something they can just enjoy for half an hour at a time. Sit them down in front of Attack of the Cybermen and they're going to be utterly, utterly lost. And it's not very entertaining and it's actually got leaves quite a bitter taste in the mouth. Sit them down in front of Paradise Towers and not only can they instantly recognize each of these three factions within the Paradise Towers, but they can enjoy each of the separate performances as well from a different perspective. The cannibal grannies, that's hilarious for a grown-up who doesn't watch science fiction. And the satire with the caretakers and the dryness, and then the Kangs is something that they can just chuckle at. Do you know what I mean?
Do you know what? You hit the nail on the head there. The cannibal scenes, actually, are like a cross between a sitcom and a soap opera. And you get this, there was a scene where Richard Briers goes in and he's saying, you know, don't panic and all this sort of stuff about her friend being thrown in the garbage chute or whatever. But there's a moment where he says the words very dry and nothing in that sentence is funny. But there's a comedy sting that Kev McCulloch has thrown in.
Oh, really?
You listen and it goes or something like that. And I was waiting for the canned laughter and clapping. And actually, it did make me think, yeah, that's what this feels like. It feels like a bit of a bad sitcom. You know, not a good one, a bit of a bad one. But
it's a satire.
The legs sticking out the back of the cleaner and things like that.
Yeah, it does work after a while, I know. But for that little scene, you look at it in isolation, it's like, what? I want to see somebody put canned laughter and clapping through the whole thing, just to see what happens.
It's more of a satire than a sitcom, but it does. The Cannibal Grannies bit does have sitcom elements. It's like Hyacinth Bouquet on lysergic acid.
Yeah, actually, do you know what? It could have been quite a kind of Mike McMahon drawn 2018. Yeah. Well, actually, a Doctor Who strip.
Yeah, it'd be good. It'd make a great Doctor Who strip. That's what it feels like. It does feel like a Doctor Who strip, the story.
Yeah. And so, for converse reasons, does Delta and Abandonment. It feels like a comic strip as well, but an entirely different kind of comic strip.
Yeah, DC.
And I think, I think at the time, Delta and Abandonment and Paradise Towers felt so far apart from one another, it was difficult to see the similarities. And actually, there are a lot of similarities in the way the characters are delineated as well. Delta and Abandonment, I don't think it does it quite as well in Delta and Abandonment because poor old Delta is badly written and badly played and badly directed. And I think where the heart of the story should be there, I think you've got a bit of a hole. But I think the rest of it is brilliant. The sort of teenage kids in 1950s Wales, and the Bannermen themselves, and the, you don't see much of the passengers on the spaceship, but the stuff with Ken Dodd and the bus driver and everything else, it's a bit like Paradise Towers in that they're all playing differently, but it comes together very nicely. We should move on to Dragonfire, unless anybody's got anything else on Paradise Towers. Oh, I tell you what, we shouldn't move on to Dragonfire because we haven't talked about Richard Briers, have we?
Well,
we have touched on this on a previous episode, but
yeah. Well, I'll say my piece, and then you say your piece, yeah, and then we'll go. If that's okay, I was only going to say, in the absence, you know, here's my, not a theory, but here's why I don't find it so offensive, shall we say. When you watch a story, especially a science fiction story, or especially an action story, or some kind of an adventure, you expect to build towards a climax. And generally the climax will involve either stunts, or action, or special effects of some kind, to sort of bring the tone of the piece into a crescendo. Now, the trouble with Paradise Towers is, it's all set in these same dank corridors throughout. So you're not going to get to a crescendo from the sets. You're not going to get to a crescendo by moving into the big location, like at the end of a Bond film, where you move into, you know...
There's the hotel swimming pool at the end.
Well, the end is at the start to it. But you know what I mean? You're not going to get to Dr. No's lair at the end of Paradise Towers. You do get to a kind of lair, but, you know, it's a cheap BBC lair in a very small studio. You need to get to a crescendo in one way or another, and the only thing I can say about Richard Briers' performance at the end there is that he does start off, and throughout the whole piece is playing it very sardonically. You know, he's playing it with his tongue in his cheek throughout the whole piece, and then at the end, he gets taken over by somebody else, and he has to ratchet the performance up, because that's the only way you can tell that he's been taken over. And by doing that, he brings the third act to a crescendo at the end of the story. And although he is by no means a sort of desirable performance that somebody, the writer, sat down and said, this is what I want from the actor during these scenes at the end, it does kind of bring the story to a head right at the end. And that's how I pass it off.
So the character and, you know, the way he performs it is satisfactory within the kind of remit of the acting styles we're already looking at, to be honest. I mean, he is a Shakespearean actor, this guy, and he was doing it before, you know, Paradise Towers, and he was great in Good Life and Custard, as we all know, Ribbon Custard. He's a great, great actor, and what I'm seeing here is that, you know, nobody was going to argue with whatever version he was going to do of this character. Mm. And he probably chose it and goes, I think I'll do it like this, like a little Hitler. And they all went, oh, Mr. Briers, that'd be fine. I'm sure he just went ahead and did whatever he wanted to do. But the...
Isn't this a story, though, where the director made him not do it like that, but every time got the cameras... I think I'm thinking of Paul Darrow in Time Lapse.
Yeah, Paul Darrow, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
But the I'm laughing because I'm finding it hard to keep a straight face, remembering him. He painted his face in silver or something. Rubbish.
In the title
sequence. It's rubbish. And then he just does this over-the-top bit of acting, which is directed so badly. You get the back of him quite a few times, and you think, hang on, when you're talking, you need to be facing this way, not over there, unless you've got a really good mic. And I think the only thing that can really top his terrible performance is probably the worst villain ever in Doctor Who is the, what's it called, the Croagnon or something? The Croagnon?
Croagnon.
Where he walks. Isn't it just two light bulb filaments?
Yeah.
Is that all, that's cheap. All it is, with a bit of fog around it. It's the...
It's the macro. It's the macro.
No, the macro are... You know, that's a high-end sculpture compared to that piece of crap. I've never seen anything so terrible. And it was that point that I got really cross with the telly and I wanted to just put my foot through it. That was the moment when I got really angry. I thought, how dare you do this to my series? What are you doing? And then he made it worse by acting. We're like a stupid, possessed idiot. But anyway, there you go. I'm laughing about it now.
Okay, yeah. Let's take a few more emails. Damien Ashley says, a real struggle to rank them. They're not stories I've ever felt the need to rewatch. I suppose Dragonfire is the least offensive, but really, this is the show's nadir season. I've always had a soft spot for McCoy since Vision On, but I hated his costume, and the whole season was a bad pantomime. Of course, it got better after season 24, but there is little to recommend here. This podcast should consist of 60 minutes of wailing and crying whilst JR goes on about how that funny little Welshman on the holiday camp bus wasn't that bad.
I think it's pretty much what it has been, isn't it?
Pretty much. Mark Whiteley says, I was 7 when Time in the Rani was on, and I haven't watched it again since. I remember the special effects and the whole story being amazing, and I plan on keeping my memory intact.
Yes, and it is amazing.
When you're 7. I told you it was. Dan Barrett says, see, here's the thing. I actually like Delta and the Bannermen. I actually think Delta and the Bannermen, rather, is one of the best Sylvester McCoy stories. It's just pure, unadulterated joy. After all the cynicism and nastiness of the Colin Baker era, this story is a joyous example of the series getting its mojo back. Great period setting and just a huge big slice of comic book fun. Ken Dodd is wonderful. The chase scenes are great and Sylvester is just having a ball. Utterly silly and brilliant fun. There you go. Dan Barrett.
Between Alan P. Jack and Dan Barrett, I mean, I call these people my friends. I'm having to... Seriously.
Me and Dan, we were talking about this the other night, and we had this... It wasn't an argument, but it's the first time we've ever had a major disagreement. And it was just a very odd situation where we were out in the middle of a street, in quite a rough street in Exeter, actually. There is one. And he was looking at me, and I was looking at him. And from a distance, it probably looked like we were going to gouge each other's eyes out. But we simply just were just disagreeing that I didn't like Delta, and he absolutely loved her.
Yeah, oh, somebody asked Lee if you're doing your podcast in the car in the dark again tonight.
Not tonight. That was good fun, though. I will do it again.
It was.
You've gone round Simon's ass tonight, haven't you?
I have. That's probably why I'm sounding a little bit crispier on the microphone.
Crispier. One more email. It's a long one, and we'll finish the podcast with that. But for now, our number one story for season 24, as voted for by the listeners of the Blue Box podcast, is Dragonfire. Well, what does anybody think of Dragonfire?
Of all the stories, it's kind of the most well-rounded, and as you say, it's the most traditional Doctor Who story, really. It's got a good villain. It's got some good effects. It's got a monster.
And the nice thing about a monster is that the monster's revealed to be benevolent rather than villainous.
Yeah, but then they take its head off at the end. That's really sad.
Yeah.
I thought that was a bit much, really. I mean, was it? They kept talking like it was alive, and then, but it was a machine. I don't really understand.
It was a.
I don't really understand how somebody explained to me how that bloke was there imprisoned there, but the Dragonfire was there. But he was kind of chasing it. Some of it didn't add up, but I was about to say it's a well-rounded story, and then I started thinking, no, there's bits that don't add up. But
no, it's not really a well-rounded story. It's a collection of set pieces, really, yeah, Dragonfire. Exactly. I was going to say it's a collection of set pieces rather than a story, but I find it a very entertaining collection of set pieces.
Yeah, absolutely. It entertained me. I was looking forward to watching each episode. I watched an episode a night, and I was looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get on to Sabalon Glitz in a minute, but I thought he was one of the best additions in this. And the fact that you had two companions in the same episode, and they were both pretty good in it as well. Melanie Bush was pretty good. I thought she was all right. And Ace was all right. You don't like Ace, do you? Do you like Ace?
I like Ace. I think she was a victim of what she was given.
Yeah, but she was 16. That the character 16. That sorry, I don't know whether I'm trumping you yet, but people go on about how annoying she is by saying bilge bag and all this business. She was 16. So I thought, well, actually, I'd forgotten how young she was supposed to be. She was fed these lines.
It wasn't Sophie's choice.
Hey. But he's been waiting all year to say that.
That just came out. I'm sorry.
No, but it is a patchy story, I think. But I really like Sabalon, you know, when he's in it. For some reason, I just think it turns into Hitchhikers a bit, you know, it gives me that feeling.
Do you know what my favourite bit was,
go
though?
Go on.
Where he puts his seatbelt on when he gets into the Nosferatu.
Yeah.
One click every trip.
Yeah, it's hilarious, isn't it? Yeah, no, it's a bizarre story. But I was remembering watching it in 80, when was it, 87, and looking at the creature thinking, oh, that's the alien, that's Alien, isn't it?
Yeah.
Giga's Alien. Plainly they just nabbed it and ripped it off, and they got a whole lot of army soldiers running through chasing it, so nice.
It was designed, insofar as I'm aware, by the same guy who designed the Alien. Am I right, Mark?
Oh, well, that's news to me.
Oh, I thought this would be right up your street, this kind of knowledge. I don't know, I've got nowhere I can look it up right now, but I was under the impression that the Dragon in Dragonfire was designed by the same guy who designed the Alien. I could be wrong then. But the whole story, that is deliberately like the aliens in Alien, because the whole story is not just a collection of set pieces, but also a series of homages to, it's Ian Briggs who wrote it, isn't it? A series of homages to his favourite films. Aliens, The Bug Hunt, you've got the Raiders of the Lost Ark thing at the end. Mm. Yeah, and then you've even got stuff like, and this was an Andrew Cartmell line, I think, where he sticks in that line about the semiotic thickness. All sorts of different influences are coming to bear on this. And in the end, it feels like the most traditional story, but actually what it is no kind of a story at all. It's just lots of different things all thrown together. Because it kind of has a through line, it feels like a story where they're on the quest for this creature, and actually this creature turns out to be, you know, the treasure that they're seeking, and the treasure that they're seeking turns out to be, you know, the thing that you need, the MacGuffin that you need, that you'll get rid of the villain and all this kind of stuff. And the villain's got a nice backstory where he's frozen himself because his loved one has died, and he wants to find some way to try and kind of, you know, either bring her back to life.
That is a beautiful statue, by the way, that he has made. Gorgeous.
A very cheap looking.
Of course, the irony is that everyone who gets frozen suffers from amnesia. But he wants to forget, but he doesn't forget.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's lots of nice ideas, and yes, there's a sort of a through line, but because you've got all this other stuff coming to bear on it, unlike, you know, it's the absolute antithesis of Delta and the Bannermen, and Paradise Towers is perhaps somewhere in between. Delta and the Bannermen, all the ideas feel fresh, and all the characters feel fresh, and everything about that story feels new and original. And Paradise Towers is somewhere in between. A lot of it feels sort of fresh, but you kind of half recognize where it might have come from. Mm. Whereas Dragonfire, you stick it on, and none of it feels fresh, and none of it feels original. But by the same token, it's so nicely written, and there's some wonderful dialogue and great and interesting characters and great concepts.
Oh, I love the security guard. That is brilliant.
In Paradise Towers, talking about Dragonfire. Oh, Dragonfire, yeah.
Oh, sorry, in Dragonfire, yeah.
Yeah, not the caretaker, the security guard. But it's very similar again to the bit in Paradise Towers where Sylvester McCoy opens up the rule book and gets the caretakers on their own rules. And again, there's another scene in Happiness Patrol where he talks the assassins out of shooting somebody. Mm. There are lots of similar threads. Sorry, what's going on?
Sorry, somebody's phone was doing its little thing. The bits with the security guard reminds me of the bit with the conversation with the Vogon before he jettisons Ford and Arthur out into space. It's the same thing, isn't it?
Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were. Think, you know, the most annoying part of the whole of Dragonfire is when you know, the Doctor's hanging off that famous cliff edge, and Clara Oswald's knocking at the door, and she can't get in because the door's closed. Oh, so what's she even doing there?
To give credit to Stephen Moffat, I saw that bit, and I've become very fond of that bit.
Yeah, I mean, while we're on it, is that okay if I quickly mention that? Because obviously, for years, we all laughed at that, going, "What the hell was that about?" Yeah. You know, he climbs down his brolly and gets himself in stupid trouble, and that's supposed to be the cliffhanger, literally. But of course, it was explained that, you know, what was written down didn't come across visually, and that he was just trying to get down to a second ledge. That's all. That's what it was all about. And actually, he does in the end. He gets down. But
somehow,
you know,
Sabalong's lips finds his way down without getting.
Yeah, exactly. But it gets lost in the, you know. So there he is hanging by his brolly at the end, with absolutely no reason, as far as the viewers can see, why he's done that. It just needed a line saying, "Oh, I think I'll get down to that ledge," and that's my Sylvester.
Instead, we now think of Clara with the subtitles underneath of her banging on the window, going, "Doctor, what the bloody hell are you doing,
idiot?"
No, but what you missed was the deleted scene with Clara, is where he sees her looking through the window, and she's pointing down and saying, "There's a ledge just underneath you. Look there."
Oh,
or maybe not.
Right.
Or maybe not.
Maybe that would be the yes. Okay, I'll go with that.
I feel a little bit sorry for the guy who designed the dragon costume, because I think if it wasn't lit like an episode of Blue Peter, I think it probably would have looked better.
And with Sylvester McCoy doing his Cher acting, shoop, shoop all over the place, and nobody else is bothering.
Yeah.
The special effect with the melty face is awesome. Still looks great now. Mm. And I love a pointy hat.
Okay.
Yeah, peak helmet.
Mark, with hair like yours, I can imagine you love any kind of a hat.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I've never seen Mark wear a hat.
Oh. You can't say hair like yours when he doesn't have any, though, can he?
Well, yeah.
Again, Lee.
You're catching me up, Lee.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. I'll be there soon. Don't you worry.
Some great acting in this.
Yep, go on.
I was just going to say, great acting in this. Kane, the guy who plays Kane, I can't remember his name. Fantastic. Some not so great acting in this. Some of the actors playing some of the guy who does the speech, the security guard that you were talking about, he's great.
Is that the one that looks like Stephen Moffat?
No, not the one who looks like Stephen Moffat. I'm just trying to remember names and calling them to mind, and I'm going.
He's in Porridge,
blank.
Wasn't he? The guy who looks like Stephen Moffat.
What, Simon?
Really?
It was in Porridge.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, it was.
Can't remember his name.
Yeah, I'm sure it was, yeah. Mm. Yeah, you're right about the acting, though. It's that's the kind of villain you want. I mean, that's like you put him and Richard Bryars next to each other, and, you know, this guy wins hands down. And he's got a good backstory. He's got a reason to be who he is, I think, anyway. And maybe I'm mixing it up with a novel. I can't remember how much was on screen now. But it was... it made sense, and he was quite a horrible piece of work. He was a proper villain, you know. He touches
quite
you
a lot of
you
it on the
get ice burn.
Screen. Yeah. Oh so yeah,
I'm
yeah.
I'm intrigued
yeah.
to know what you did for your epilogue with, is it Glitz and Mel?
Oh yeah.
Did you have them in your epilogue?
They're in the epilogue for Paradise Towers. Yeah. Mm. It was the at the end. The guy who ends up being the head guy at Paradise Towers looks out of a window and he sees Mel and Sabalong Glitz turn up, and they're obviously an item because there's a daughter as well, and Mel's dragged him back there to do some shopping or something like that.
Oh dear.
And Sabalong Glitz is there looking to heavens saying, somebody
looking a bit henpecked,
somebody save me from this. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I shan't
I
say
I didn't write it, I just drew it.
okay, I think we're running out of steam, guys. I think we should take Ian Martin's email and move on, shall we?
Yeah.
Okay. Final thoughts on season 24, though? Simon, your rewatch, did you find it improved over what you were expecting? Or?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I drew from it far more positives than I fully expected to. As I say, I still got this issue with... It's not even an issue. It's Delta, I just do not like it. And I'm not going to lie to anyone by trying to... paper over the cracks and say, oh yeah, but if you look at it, there's so much I dislike about it, and it just embodies the worst of what I don't enjoy. But the rest of it, and story wise, even in Delta, I can see what was going on there, and it was an ambitious season. But it's almost like Andrew Cartman. It's almost like with John Nathan Turner, it's, you know, be careful what you wish for. And Andrew Cartmel probably gave him more than he bargained for, and they could never live up to what needed to be done with it.
Yeah.
So it's a big folly of a series, and people can call it a mistake, but it was very brave. We use that word a lot, I know, but it was very brave. And for that, I give it credit, and I can appreciate it for that. And I've certainly gained a new love for Dragonfire. Yeah.
And I think it pays huge dividends over the next 2 years as well, because they're finding their feet with this. They're having these weird, crazy ideas and not quite making them work. And then the following year, they take some similarly crazy ideas and by and large do make them work. Happiness Patrol and Greatest Show in the Galaxy are two fantastic stories.
I wish they'd maybe... Again, I think the Doctor went too dark afterwards. That's my only criticism, and I'd like to have seen more of a midway house for McCoy's Doctor. But you know, people know I've got issues with the Merlin thing and that. So,
oh, I like the Merlin thing. It's the special Time Lord thing that I'm not too keen on.
Mm.
Well, you know what I said about that before.
It is a mixed bag this season, isn't it? And I'm just going to echo everything that's already been said, really, but the season is Andrew Cartmell basically saying it should be like this, and everything else is trying to catch up with his brilliant ideas. I mean, I'm not going to say that he's necessarily a genius, because, you know, that's Stephen Moffat kind of genius we're looking at. It's completely different. But I would say that he had some absolutely cracking ideas and thoughts, and whatever the writers were being told to do by him were doing they were trying their best. But it just couldn't. That the series itself, JNT, like Simon said, I don't think got it until the last season in 89. And I agree also with Simon, the fact that McCoy in Dragonfire, I think, and the beginning of the next season was just about right with his darkness. And it was, as much as Andrew Cartmell had a fantastic idea to make him darker, he possibly just had the wrong actor to do it with as well, because I still don't believe Sylvester McCoy's darkness in anything, and he can't shout. So never give him a shouting scene. So yeah, it's a mixed bag this season. Bit of a cliche, I'm afraid, but and I will probably rewatch it again with my son at some point and watch him cringe. I might film him actually cringing.
Just out of interest, and it's quite appropriate, is that Finn is actually sat behind us watching television or watching a DVD with his headphones on, and he's watching Indiana Jones and the Last What was the one? Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Yeah. Yes,
that's quite appropriate, isn't it?
It is. If he'd been watching the first one whilst we were talking about
Raiders,
Kane,
it would have been completely inappropriate.
His head melting, that'd have been perfect.
Lee, I'm interested to know. You like Big Finish, don't you?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
What do you think of McCoy in those?
Oh, great. I really like him in those. It gives him... I mean, he's close to a microphone, so whenever he has to do his shouting business or whatever, it actually feels a lot better, and you can adopt his voice a little bit. Not adopt, adapt, rather. That would be weird, adopting his voice. But, yeah, no, I think he's much, much better than that, and he's tempered more, and I think the direction in those are really good. It's the same with Mel. Her character, you know, Bonnie Langford, she's brilliant in the Big Finish audios. Absolutely fantastic. And her reading of Paradise Towers, guys, very good. So, yeah.
Mark, any final thoughts?
Oh, I think it's a transitional period, but that's a bit of an old cliche, really. Yeah, I think at the time I found it incredibly embarrassing to watch, and I actually stopped watching for a few years and didn't really come back to it. I think I remember seeing the trailers for Remembrance, whenever that would have been after. Was that the following year? I can't remember now.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, after Time in the Rani, stopped watching and then came back to it from Remembrance onwards. But, yeah, it was a weird time. But I think he got stronger and stronger as he went on. But 24, yeah, it's a bit of a mixed bag. But I think I'd like to think we were all fairly positive about it, even Simon.
Yeah. Well, here's Ian Martin then. He says, a season
Ian
of... Ian Martin. The joke doesn't get any funnier the more you repeat it, Mark.
I'd like to try, though.
I'm not going to make the joke about it. It's very trying. A season of two halves, says Ian Martin. Two of the stories I bought on VHS, two I haven't seen since original transmission. I remember buying my first Doctor Who magazine, the season preview edition, I think, before season 24 began. I remember the cold autumn evenings and practically running home from my swimming lesson to be home in good time for the return of Doctor Who. Still smarting from the sacking of Colin Baker, and with no great expectations of McCoy from all the kids' BBC stuff I'd seen him in, I wasn't sure what to expect. I'd just started at big school about 3 weeks earlier, so like Doctor Who, it was a time of great change for me too. My dad, who had watched the show religiously for Hartnell, from Hartnell through to the end of Troughton, had largely been driven out of his mind by my Doctor Who obsession and didn't watch anymore. But he watched part one of Time in the Rani with me. It was the last episode he watched until Rose. At Time in the Rani 1, I wasn't quite sure what I'd seen. I wasn't sure it was as brilliant as the trial had been. I didn't know if I liked the new theme music. I definitely didn't like the logo. By the end of part 4, I suspected things weren't quite as good as they could be. But I kept on. Paradise Towers, I seem to recall, had good scripts, but was let down mainly by Briars. I think we can all agree this has, at heart, great ideas. The writer, Stephen Wyatt, was a nice guy, and encouraging to me, an aspiring writer when I met him at a convention in 1988. P.S. If any of your listeners have Kindles and like episodic science fiction in the Doctor Who Orphan Black mold, check out my e-book Winter Hill on Amazon. Was that a free advert I just gave him there?
That was. Very possibly. Yeah. You can send us a fiver for that.
I think he should. That's what happened. Delta and Bannermen, I recall vaguely. I loved potential new companion Ray. Henderson was great. Even Dodd didn't get me too badly bullied in the playground the next day. I think this one was okay and probably the first indication of what the McCoy era could be like. I recall enjoying the novel a lot and oddly some of the music too. Dragonfire I recall vividly as I watched it a heck of a lot. I recall dangling down the staircase by my umbrella pretending to be the Doctor. Why the hell was he doing that at the end of part one? And the melting of Kane was awesome. The big reservation was that little 11-year-old me suspected that Sophie Aldred simply couldn't act. And this has been borne out, as listeners to the Season 27 releases in particular can attest. Now, if I could see it, why couldn't anyone in the production office? I was a bit down when the season ended, but stayed loyal and was rewarded with Seasons 25 and 26, which were, at the time, great, simply great. Was season 24 the weakest in the show's history? It felt tired, unloved, reworked but lifeless, and even the huge injection of a new script editor, doctor, title sequence and storytelling ethos couldn't prevent the threadbare production from making acutely uncomfortable viewing. Something was just ever so slightly off. Sylvester McCoy's first four episodes were not good, but by the end of the season he was definitely the Doctor. Bonnie Langford should have been the weakest link, but I'd take her over Sophie Aldred any day. Just watch that bit in Battlefield Episode 2 where she says boom and then tell me she wasn't struggling. Also, this season marked the start of the essential TARDIS-lessness of the McCoy era. I've always loved the TARDIS, but by Season 24 we weren't even getting to go inside that often anymore. Yes, this probably was as bad as things got in my time, but I only started watching in 1981, so could only compare with the Root and Sayward eras. It's probably not the unmitigated excrement a lot of fandom seem to maintain it is, but the hiatus happened at the wrong time. If the show had been suspended after the trial, and the writers had had a bit more time to come up with something special, this series could have felt a bit more loved and a bit less slapdash. I hate to criticise anyone's work on this show, and certainly nobody set out to make a weak season, but if someone with all the critical faculties of an obsessive 11-year-old could spot it was a bit embarrassing, often miscast and poorly produced, then it's no wonder most critics and viewers found themselves working up such a national apoplexy. But I'm sure Lee can cover all this with his pity. I'm sure Lee can cover all this with his pithy, it's shit.
Actually, I don't think I did say that, did I?
No, you didn't.
No, you said crap this time.
I did say crap, but that was only for the light bulb moment.
Can I just say, I don't think we should underestimate the effect. I mean, certainly personally, I started watching Time of the Rani with a real bad taste in my mouth. The fact, fully knowing that Colin Baker had left against his wishes.
Yeah.
That it really, you know, it was very hard to... There was a... You know, my loyalty to the show had taken a real knock, I have to say. So... That it really did start on a bad foot.
And I was like Mark, actually, which I think I've probably mentioned before. Time Flight was a moment that knocked me. But this Time in the Rani just, yeah, I was the same. I didn't watch it until I saw the trailers for Remembrance of the Daleks and then came back to it then and really enjoyed it. And Curse of Fenric was the one that kind of made me think, wow, the Doctor's back. This is great. Whether or not I feel like that now, I don't know. But
even though I struggled with this at the time, I still much preferred it to the previous two seasons. Did then and do now. And look, okay, final thought for the night. I know that most people seem to think season 24 was them finding their feet, not being very successful at it, and that they grew into it, and by season 25 and the Dalek story, and season 26, and things like Curse of Fenric, and Survival, and Ghostlight, they knew what they were doing. But I would say that by getting rid of the rough edges, they lost a little bit of the imagination. And I don't think a story like Curse of Fenric or a story like Survival has got anything like the sense of wonder at what you can do with Doctor Who as stories like Paradise Towers and Delta and Abandonment do. And so for that reason, I think I probably do prefer season 24 out of all three of the McCoy series. You know, I think if season 24 had been Paradise Towers, The Happiness Patrol, The Greatest Show in the Galaxy, and Delta and Abandonment, I think that would be my perfect late 80s Doctor Who season. And with that, we'll say goodnight, shall we?
You have always been a contrarian, JR.
Well, I can't help it. It's true. I you know, if I was going to sit down and watch a McCoy story, I'd be so much more likely to put Paradise Towers on than The Curse of Fenric, and so much more likely to put Delta and Abandonment on than Survival. There's just no two ways about it.
Please address all your hate mail to J.R. Southall.
Okay, then. And until next...
I was going to say, just start with the words, it's shit, and you're done.
No. Not necessary.
Hey, less of the swearing. My 5-year-old daughter said bloody hell today. I'm devastated.
And that's Lee's fault. That's Lee's fault.
That's not what I said either.
Right, until next week. And I've no idea what we're doing next week yet, so I'm not going to preview it by saying what it is. Oh, it could be the Crap Monsters one. Oh, or yeah. That could be the week after.
We're on a roll.
Yeah, no, I think it is. It's Crap Monsters next week.
Hey.
Yeah, but with Crap Monsters, we can do what we've done with season 24 and find the things to like in them. Or exactly. The reasons why they don't work, yeah, rather
why
than just saying...
Nymon are one of the best monsters ever.
Well, nobody's... Improved. Nymon haven't been nominated enough by our listeners to be included, Mark.
That's because they're too good.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to include them anyway, just for your benefit.
What?
They are.
How dare you?
They are one of those monsters that is traditionally regarded as crap, Mark. We'll have them in there.
Yeah, well. Lee mentioned the Chumblies earlier, and I didn't think they were too bad.
Ooh,
Chumblies
and the Crotons. Well, yeah, people know I love the Crotons.
So much so that you've called yourself DJ Croton at our cabaret that we're putting on. That's brave.
The Chumblies are dreadful, and so are the Crotons, and at the. You know, at the risk of doing next week's episode now, shall we leave this conversation?
Yeah, we best. Go on.
Okay, until the week of the Crap Monsters, I was JR.
I was Lee.
I was Mark.
And I was Simon.
And we'll speak again soon.